Welcome to Talks Around a Farm Table, a podcast about the diverse landscape of agriculture on Kodiak Island. This series is driven by Kodiak Soil Water Conservation District in collaboration with KMXT Radio. I am your host, Ian Zacher. Hello, farmers, growers, and ranchers. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Talks Around a Farm Table. I'm your host, Ian, with the co-host, Blythe Brown, and another co-host, Masumi Palaf, who are part of the Kodiak Soil and Water District's acting district manager and invasive weeds expert, respectively. Today's guest is Gino Graziano, who is a researcher at UAF, the UAF Extension Services Invasive Plant Instructor based out of Anchorage. Today, he's going to talk about weeds, invasive species, and pesticides. And hopefully, I can get him to talk a little bit about biologicals. So go ahead.
Cool. I'm Gino, as mentioned. I've been working in various jobs on invasive species management, primarily with plants, since about 2006, I think. I started out working with soil and water conservation districts with the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts in Palmer Soil and Water, and then worked with the state for a little bit. But I've been at the university for the longest time now, probably 14 or so, maybe more years. But anyway, somewhere in that realm. And I've been doing work with invasive plants and research on management of those, as well as pesticide fate. Other projects we have deal with forest health issues like spruce beetle and other things, and then we're dabbling in biological controls both on in farm areas as well as in wildlands. So
excellent, you got your fingers in just about everything there, it seems like.
Yeah, try to keep them out of a few things, but in a few too many.
Today we're going to talk to you about invasive species and how to manage some invasive species, and hopefully kind of maybe get some of the mysteriousness and maybe some of the bad feelings about pesticides and how they are useful in certain instances. Maybe you can explain where they are, what use they're stronger for, and maybe instances where they're not as effective. Mm-hmm. But as a foundation to let our listeners kind of have like a foundational knowledge, everyone has different ideas of what pesticides are. But pesticide is an umbrella term, correct? Could you think that you can maybe touch on the different types of pesticides and what they're used for?
So pesticides are a big umbrella term for pretty much anything that is a chemical meant to kill or deter something. So everything from like your antimicrobial hand wash that we all use and bug sprays for like the DEET or even the natural scent oils or whatever that we use for insect repellents on our own personal bodies, up to stuff that's either insecticides or herbicides that are meant to kill insects or plants. In those situations, and they can be derived from natural things, the essential oils and things like that that can be used for as pesticides. And then they can also be synthetically created in labs, often mimicked after naturally occurring plant hormones and other things that and then they get tested and tried out in the field before they get used.
Excellent, excellent. And so the types are insecticides, which is meant to affect insects, and then there's pesticides. And then there's herbicides that take out plants. Some of the common misconceptions about some of those are they're dangerous, that they are inefficient, they don't work. So could you talk about maybe some of the reasons why people might have those feelings?
Well, what we have to kind of remember is that virtually everything has some risk to it. And so, and pesticides, herbicides, insecticides are not immune from that risk. So what we need to do with those and anything else that we're using is make sure that we're using them appropriately and the way that they're intended to be used. And so if you are taken herbicide to work on, you know, an invasive plant species, and you follow those label instructions, wear all the appropriate personal protective equipment when you're mixing it, loading it, applying it, apply it during weather that's appropriate for that, and post up signage to keep people from entering the site and getting exposed to it prior, you know, for as long as that label intends, then they're as harmless as most anything else that we would do in our daily lives. Because that, by applying them during the right weather, you know, without rain in the forecast, things like that, you prevent the runoff that can get into the water, the streams, you allow that herbicide to absorb into the plant completely, so then it's no longer available for the rest of us to like rub up against or anything like that, and they can be applied safely in that way. Now, if you start bending those rules and you go out and you're, you know, spraying dandelions in your lawn wearing a pair of sandals and no gloves, and it's windy outside, you know, yeah, you're going to get it, you know, on yourself or others and things around you, and it won't be as effective either because you're not going to get the dose that you need on the plants that you want. So it's really all about using things appropriately.
And all those things are labeled, right, on the pesticide itself.
The EPA extensively studies these things with, in partnership with the manufacturers, because the manufacturers have to take the risk and put all the money up to do those studies. And it's very similar to like pharmaceuticals. And pharmaceuticals are probably the only thing that's more extensively studied prior to release than pesticides. Pesticides are like right up there with being studied for their environmental impacts and impacts to human health as pharmaceuticals.
And they have to, if I understand it correctly, right, every 10 years they have to reevaluate the pesticide itself, right?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact year cycle that goes on with that, but there have definitely been some that have been reviewed for as while I've been employed doing this kind of work. And yeah, they get reviewed every now and again. They can be reviewed more often if there's issues associated with them. And then to top that off, every state, a pesticide gets registered and made allowed to be used by the EPA, but then states actually allow the use within the state too. So a pesticide company has to basically register the product in the state, and the state can say no. So certain pesticides that are always found in water or things like that really like just, you know, continues to run off. Some states like Alaska have just said no to.
Do you know any of those off the top of your head?
Yeah, the one that is used with herbicides a lot in other parts of the country is picloram. It's found in products like Tordon and things like that. It moves really readily in water, but also in soil particles and things like that, and persists for quite a long time without breaking down. And our Alaska DEC has basically said no to using picloram for as long as I can remember.
Probably, it's probably for the better, like when you have lots of water runoff, given Alaska's waterways are vital to salmon.
Yeah. And generally speaking, you know, there are alternatives that will work equally as well in other situations. So when you pick a herbicide or pesticide to use, you take into account the environmental factors in the area, what you're trying to manage, pick from the list of things that will manage it, which one fits best into the environmental scenario that you're in and has whatever advantages it might be. Sometimes persistence is an advantage to, you know, take out a seed bank if it's soil persistent for a while. You know, sometimes you don't want that persistence because you want to be planting something afterwards, soon after managing.
So very regulated, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is very regulated, and a lot of it comes down to, you know, once it's allowed for use, that's where the regulation kind of ends in other than the rules about using it, wind speed, et cetera, and following the label instructions. The applicator, whoever that happens to be, the homeowner or Masumi, myself, have to make a lot of other decisions too about which one's going to be the best for this situation.
Yeah. And so that kind of like wraps into the different types of pesticides that we've got. We've got registered and restricted, right? Not everyone can just go get any pesticide that they want, correct? Like you have to be, there are certain pesticides that are restricted use only, and that only certain licensed people for that particular type of treatment can do it, right?
So it's more that there's general use pesticides and restricted use is what they are. And there's very few restricted use pesticides, but you're correct. Like if you are going after restricted use pesticides, and I don't know the exact ones, but generally they're like insecticides, then you have to be a certified pesticide applicator with a license to even purchase the stuff. You also have to have a license to sell it. So they can't you can't just go buy it at like the hardware store. There has to be sold by a certified pesticide dealer as well. So, but most pesticides that we talk about and get used are general use. So as long as you're applying to your own property that you own and manage, you don't necessarily have to have that license. But if you're applying to property that you don't own and manage, or in and or as a commercial application, then you need to have that license from the Department of Environmental Conservation, which basically shows that you've gone through a training, tells you all the rules and regulations, and gives you various other background on safety and things like that.
Right, it kind of prevents me as a farmer to, I can treat my farm, but I can't treat my neighbor's farm.
Yeah, and that's actually something I think that gets overlooked sometimes. People just don't read into that, and it's like, you know, somebody's kid is, you know, doesn't live with them anymore, so technically they're not really part of their family. Or maybe you're just doing a favor for your neighbor or somebody in the church or something, and they're like, oh yeah, I'll put some weed and feed down on your lawn. You're technically not supposed to do that because it's not property that you own or manage. It should be done by a certified pesticide applicator.
Blaise, did you have anything?
I was wondering if you could just maybe speak on the natural versus chemicals public image of
Oh
herbicides.
yes, we've got we get lots of comments, social media, talking about the natural remedies and some of the homemade stuff versus, you know, some of the stuff you buy at the store. So, for instance, like Blythe has just shown me here a 20% vinegar weed killer, and people are just spraying everything. And so the question that I think she was getting at is like the natural versus the chemical, and some of maybe the warning labels that are associated between some of those.
Yeah, so the I think so there's a few parts. I'll start with like the homemade remedies. Like first, those we typically don't recommend. You know, they're not going to work as well. Like if even if you're using like the vinegar and oil thing, right? And you're like thinking like, oh, well, this commercial one's vinegar and oil. Their vinegar is a heck of a lot stronger than what you can buy at the store. And from what I've learned with our home health groups is that even the vinegar you buy at the store might not be as strong as you need to can pickles and things. So you got to really pay attention to that part. So you might see like you might get like some browning on your dandelions from that stuff, but it's not going to do the same as what you will if you buy like the high concentrated vinegars from the hardware store that are a certified product, I mean a pesticide. The other thing to remember is those don't come without risk as well. They will have directions on there that tell you like what sort of personal protective equipment you're supposed to use and what's gonna, you know, and other things you need to be doing. So like you shouldn't be going and buying that you know, acetic acid product to apply to weeds in your garden or lawn or wherever it happens to be, and then still not wearing gloves, doing it in your sandals without eye protection. You could really like really do a number on yourself in those situations. So I I typically, you know, they're sometimes dealt with a little bit differently, but I or seen differently because this one might be like OMRI approved. So it's like certified for used, allowed for use in organic things. But really from like a safety standpoint, there's not, for me, there's not a whole lot of difference in that application period that you're working in. They don't stick around as long. Usually that's the one thing they're, because they're natural products, they tend to break down in the soil much faster. Most of our herbicide or products, at least once they're in the soil, if they're not soil active, they do break down. They might be there longer, but they not might not be really doing much or have much impact to the area that was applied to after that application. Again, it comes back to that whole thing where we're picking the herbicide that will do what you want it to do for the time that you want to do it.
And it just goes to show that it's like when someone says natural, right, versus chemical. The warning labels, for instance, on some of these 20% vinegar, 30% vinegar herbicides carry a higher warning label than some of the ones that are like really scary, like Roundup, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's important to make that distinction. Like,
yeah, it's those acute first contact things. Yeah. Like you get Roundup on you, a glyphosate, and you should go, you know, wash it off, take a shower, launder your clothes, change your clothes, all that stuff. You get like that acid on you, and it's like you're gonna burn. Yeah. You're feeling it right away, you know. So
yeah. Some of the other things that we get is like herbicide effects on pollinators. Mostly we treat hawkweed and creeping thistle, which, if I'm not mistaken, they use two different pesticides, right? So they use different herbicides?
No, we use Milestone for both hawkweed and thistle. We use glyphosate on knotweed.
And reed canary
and
grass.
And reed canary grass.
Some of the concerns that we get is that that herbicide is sprayed and that it's killing pollinators. Specifically, like what information can you give people about using herbicides for invasive weed treatment and the effects on that on pollinators?
So there's actually a registry that Alex, who you interviewed before me, has references quite a bit that will tell, like, gives you, will lay out a pesticide and their risk for pollinators. Like if they basically are full blown risk, like this pollinator is coming into contact with this pesticide and there's that risk. And so that can be like looked up and handled. Typically though, what you can do as someone applying pesticides is think about the life state of the plant and when you're making these applications of the herbicide. So for the knotweed and that gets managed with glyphosate, and I think glyphosate is one of the lower risk ones, but you'd have to look that up, so don't quote me on that. But that said, with typically what you're going to do when you're putting glyphosate on knotweed is the plants might not be in flower. You know, we like to knock plants down in midsummer and let them grow back a little bit, which basically keeps them from getting to that flowering stage. If they're not flowering, they're not attractive to the pollinators themselves. So that's like the first way you can kind of manage a weed with minimizing the impact to pollinators. Other things you can do is trying to make your applications either earlier in the morning or later in the evening, because most pollinators aren't as active during those time periods. So then you can get it on there, hopefully it absorbs into the plant and things are all good for the pollinators and all good for your weed control.
I think that makes a great point, and all this could be found in the label if you're reading the label appropriately. And at least from the labels that I've read, they tell you like, hey, this is going to kill bees. Don't do it when they're out foraging in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
One of the ones that we, you know, that's that is common around here is people use neem oil to fight a variety of things. Like it's kind of like a cure all for a lot of things. But it specifically said, because that is also organically certified, like you can use that for an organic farm, but that will kill your foragers your pollinator foragers, mm-hmm. and it specifically says on the label, don't use during high foraging times. Use it in the evenings and or early in the mornings, so that it has a time to like has a time to do its job, but not necessarily take out your pollinators.
I want to add something too, is that a lot of people don't realize, because it is so time consuming, that when we're treating hawkweed, we pick all the flowers. We even pick flowers of other plants nearby that might get spray, so that things aren't visiting them. But it also kind of sends hawkweed back into like a state where it wants to send mm-hmm. the herbicide down to the roots. And then a lot of the times when we're treating knotweed, for example, it's late in the season, so it's not really having any flowers. Or mm-hmm. a lot of the knotweed that we have remaining is so small, and we just do like hand wiper applications. So we're not actually spraying, we're like wiping herbicide on the individual leaves. So you're also reducing it, doing like little things like that, kind of adding up. It takes more time, but it's
I think that's two great points that you made, is that A, you're not just wholesale, like you're not just wholesale spraying all over the place. And two, you make the point that like by the time, you know, the plant is already in its flowering stage, like using herbicide is really not that effective. And so you'd be a little return for spraying the flowers, right? Like, so you cut the flowers off and then you spray, and then the plant is more likely to take it up. I think that's kind of like one of those things that people miss, because they don't have that experience with herbicides. At least that I have found.
There's a lot of assumption that we're broadcasting spraying.
Yeah.
We pretty much never do. Yeah.
We can't, because number one, we don't do that because it's not really that effective. And number two, we couldn't afford it. Also, what people don't understand, I don't think that they take into consideration, is that it's very expensive to spray. It's very costly, and just not in terms of just the product itself, but to the labor and the time it does to take to do it. I think is an overlooked assumption when they see, you know, the sign out there that says, oh, we sprayed here. So do you guys have any follow-ups?
I was wondering if, Gino, if you could talk about some of the agents like photodegradation and things like that break down the herbicide, and like why a lot of herbicides aren't very active once you've treated plants.
So there's a handful of ways that herbicides basically move or leave the environment or the site that you have. I think one of the most common ones is really probably runoff, and depending on the herbicide. So, and it's not necessarily like runoff, which you think. Most herbicides don't move that far, even with water. If you're, you know, again, following that weather timing and not getting like a surface runoff event, they still get tied up in the soil, but they start to move away a little bit that way. And typically a lot of them actually degrade through hydrolysis. So, which is where the water that they're in, even the water you mix them in, starts to break them down. And so like oftentimes with certain things, if you mix it with water, as the label tells you to, it'll tell you like use this up within, you know, 12 hours, 24 hours or whatever, because it starts to break down almost immediately with that. Most everything will break down in the sun, like, you know, your tarp or your raft or whatever you have. You guys might not have too many issues with that in Kodiak, right? It looks a little bright behind you today, but the sun can break those things down too. When they're in the soil, eventually microbial degradation should occur. It varies with different chemicals how fast that microbial degradation occurs, and such. So that's the way those herbicides kind of end up leaving the site, more or less where they were applied. You know, other things that can happen, though, deal with how tightly your herbicide binds to soil. So an herbicide can bind really tightly to soil and basically be completely unavailable to plants. And so then the only things that can get to it are are microbes. And that's what happens with glyphosate, which was the, you know, one of the old ingredients of Roundup. I actually haven't seen glyphosate in the Roundup products at the hardware store that I see anymore. They've kind of moved away from it. That's fine. It's whatever. It's their decision. But then other products, there are other products that stick around in the soil for like a season or more, and bind to that soil strong enough, but typically they're going to eventually get degraded by microbes. And so glyphosate binds so strongly that it can't even be taken up by plants, and won't even get into the water after it's been bound into the soil. So that's like that's actually one of its cool attributes environmentally.
But we do have to be careful and not spray a dusty, dirty plant, because it will be bound up in that dust and dirt and not even get into the plant.
I hadn't even ever thought about that, but that is like a random but very true thing that could happen. So especially if you're working on a roadside of a gravel road or something.
Which we have a lot of here in Kodiak.
Yeah, we find that with our knotweed sometimes. We have to be careful about the dusty leaves if we've had a stretch of nice weather, because Kodiak actually has a lot of dust. We've got the ash layer here that just turns to dust as soon as it dries.
So it's nice to do treatment after, like on a nice day, after we've had some rain for a couple days or something.
That's a good point. Hose the plants off first. I never thought about that, but it makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah.
Cool. Well, maybe we've talked about the pesticides, and we've hinted at, like, we've used terms like invasive species, but there is a bit of miscommunication and maybe a misunderstanding of what an invasive species is. Maybe you can make a foundational definition of what, I mean, I know what an invasive species is, but maybe a lot of our audience may not know what that means.
So an invasive species should have two big attributes, right? It should be introduced by humans, so it didn't get here on its own or spread up here on its own, even with like a changing climate as things start to move north. That's just animals and plants adapting to those changes. So we've got to somehow bring it here, whether it's something we planted or something that, you know, was on your car tire or your boot or in a bale of hay, whatever. All those ways or things, way things can get up here on their own or with us. Then the next step, though, is like, because really very few of those things are ever going to be a problem. So it's got to cause some sort of problem, you know, spread out into the environment and be a major issue for agriculture or diminish some ecosystem service that we care about. By ecosystem service, I mean like you know, water quality or habitat for salmon or deer, bears, moose, if you're on the mainland, elk if you're out where you're at, and all of those sorts of things. So the problem aspect is really comes down to communities within that area making informed decisions. And so those decisions should be informed by biologists and scientists making assessments of what could or is happening as this species starts to spread within that local environment and different ecosystems. And then the community makes a decision about whether or not that change is acceptable. And if it's not acceptable, it should be, you know, deemed invasive, and we figure out how to manage it.
And as I understand, there is a list of invasive species per state in each state. I'm from California. There's like 1,200 invasive species in California. I don't know if Alaska has that many, but there is, by state, they have like a list, and they rate them, correct?
Don't get us going.
Yeah,
on that
and
there.
So we can,
Alaska. I'll let so Gino the, speak after me, but oh, I gotta pick. I gotta poke.
Go for it.
Alaska has a woefully inadequate invasive species list right now. So here in Kodiak, we have our own list, and we've decided that some of our highly aggressive invasive plants are. They may not be on the Alaska list, but we're still, they're important for us to be able to control.
And I think you are getting to my point, Blythe, that is that not every state has a well-represented invasive species list. And what I really wanted to touch on is that there is a tier level that people may not know about, and that some species are considered invasive, but they're not as aggressive as some others.
Exactly, exactly. So like that 1,200 that you mentioned in California might be actually like their non-native plant list, which we have one of those in Alaska too. So it's basically any species that's been found outside of cultivation, growing on its own in the state. And I think we have between 300 and 400. I don't remember the exact most recent number.
That's a lot more than I was giving. That's a lot more than I thought.
Yeah. Well, it's a big state, right? But really, like, yeah, we've assessed less than half of those. But you know, of the ones we've assessed, probably like 10 to 20% are things we should be truly thinking about as like, oh, yep, these could be problematic in this given scenario. Yeah, and then the other list that Blythe's referring to is the state's noxious weed list. And so that one is woefully short and fairly out of date. There's probably some things in there that really aren't invasive, but maybe a problematic for like if you were planting seed because it was kind of housed within a seed regulation. So if you had carrots, if you bought carrot seed that had any of these types of things, it would be a problem, right? But if you just had this thing out in the real world somewhere and it was, you know, it might not really be that big of an issue. But then there's other things on there that are definitely invasive, including like orange hawkweed and the creeping thistle that we mentioned earlier. But then it doesn't have like the Japanese knotweed or various other species that we are definitely highly concerned with.
Yeah, ones that we definitely know can spread and will spread given half a chance.
Exactly. Yeah, government moves slower than science anyway. Often and science times, tends to move slower than other species moving around and stuff too. So
we've got the understanding of an invasive species, and we've kind of talked broadly about herbicides and pesticides on how to deal with invasive species. Let's try to tie it together. So one of the biggest, like one of the biggest ubiquitous invasive species that we have here in town that everyone talks about and everyone's got a remedy and everyone's got feelings about it is hawkweed. It's everywhere here in town. And I don't have this is an arm waving, but I feel like this year has been a big spread. I'm finding it in places that I haven't seen it in years. Or ever out where I live. I'm finding it in areas that it's just like, why are you here? This doesn't make sense of why you're here. And people seem to be voicing that it's spreading more and more and more, even though they see us at the district, specifically Musumi and Blythe's treat, and it just seems like digging in sand. And people are defeated would be a good term. That's also coupled with people not understanding maybe the biology, the life cycle, of the plant itself, or the remedies in which, are presented aren't, adequate enough in their eyes. Some people, you know, are afraid of using herbicide to deal with it because they've got a well, they've got pets, they've got kids, they've got animals, and the overarching fear factor prevents them from using the tools available, because that's what herbicide is, that's what pesticide is. It's just one tool in the toolbox, as Blythe likes to say. Can you, you know, as someone who is in the industry who does deal with this on a daily occurrence, like what would be the advice that you would give someone who is wanting to get rid of this noxious weed, but too uncertain about using the appropriate tools at hand? Because you can dig it out. You can, like we were talking about the vinegar that seems to be highly popular in Kodiak, using vinegar. And that itself, has its own issues with treating hawkweed. But what would you tell reluctant people when they're dealing with a huge infestation on their property? Because there are people where it's just like their entire lawn is covered in hawkweed.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, you could create a paved parking lot, but nobody really wants to do that. Yeah. You know, I I would take and use kind of a mixed approach with that. You know, if the well is shallow and that's a real issue to worry about, there might be cultural ways to fix it in that scenario. And by cultural, I would mean like covering it up with some sort of heavy weed barrier fabric and then topping that up with something like a rock garden or whatever to give a buffer in that area. But really, like actually killing orange hawkweed other than covering it with something, and which is like solarizing, keeping the sun away from being it so it doesn't photosynthesize. You need to use an herbicide. It just like the digging it is gonna basically just make it angry. Well, it doesn't really make it angry, but it's like the starfish story where the people started cutting up the starfish. Well, now you got multiples, and it's got a root system that just likes to get broken up and things like that, and leaves little fragments behind, and it thrives on that that disturbance. So using an appropriate herbicide at appropriate distances from those things is really going to be the way to go. And if it's a lawn, if it truly is in a lawn scenario, trying to maintain a really healthy lawn afterwards goes a long ways to keeping it from reinvading back in. I'll see places in where there's a lot of hawkweed in South Central, and if there's a hawkweed on the edge of somebody's lawn or yard, and you kind of look and examine or ask how have you been managing your lawn, usually they're like, they're on it with their lawn, and that's why the hawkweed's not in the lawn.
They got their fertilizers out. They're going out.
Right.
They're putting calcium in that soil. They're putting nitrogen. They're keeping it. They're feeding the soil, so that's the hawkweed's not able to take roots, because I think that's kind of one of the hallmarks of the invasion, is that they really like terrible soil, right? They're looking for calcium deficient soil, a lot like dandelions, right? Compacted nutrients.
Yeah, and I don't know exactly which things the hawkweed gets after. It's mostly just taking advantage of some empty space and some other things. If you just changed the soil nutrients without killing it first, you'd just, that hawkweed would be like, heck yeah, I got some nitrogen and a great pH to suck up all those nutrients, and would just grow even more. So you got to kill it first, and then work on getting that, what you want to grow really well. That's like a cultural control practice.
So when it comes to treating hawkweed with a herbicide, I know that what we use here in the district, Milestone, which is not a glyphosate, but what are other people using to treat hawkweed in the terms of the herbicide realm versus, maybe like you talked about cultural practice. Are there any other practices outside of herbicide that is remotely effective?
Oh, against actually like removing hawkweed?
Yeah.
Maybe if you've got just one or two plants in very loose soil, you could pull it up. But that's about it.
Yeah.
Like it's got to be small and brand new to have a chance at doing it without herbicides, other than, covering it up with a weed barrier fabric. But you're kind of end up, I see weed barrier fabrics as an herbicide reduction, not an herbicide elimination, because that creeping root system is just going to like creep out towards the edge of it. And then it's going to go. And so then you have to keep expanding it on and on, or have a way to treat that, whether it's going to be, spraying it or pulling it or whatever. So, so Milestone can't be used in home landscapes because it's taken up by plants, and then the plants that aren't susceptible, which are the grasses, actually still have the herbicide within the plant, and it's active. So they don't want people making the mistakes of putting that on there, using it as mulch or something like that, and then getting damage elsewhere. But there's lots of other options out there for folks. Typically, things that are generally available are stuff that contains 2,4-D and or dicamba, which are found in a lot of like the weed and feeds, weed begones, things like that. And those can do, work well on hawkweed. There's also products with something called triclopyr in it, which are found in things that are used for brush killers. It's actually in a lot of the, I saw that the Roundup brand has put triclopyr in it, but they're still going after the whole ground clear thing. So they have these weird like kind of contact herbicides that kill things real fast, and then the triclopyr is just meant to kind of work for a little while longer in the ground. Yeah. So, but that can help a lot. The triclopyr can be found in products that are meant to be used in lawns and things like that too. So, but you still have to kind of pay attention to what you're doing, especially if you're around trees and shrubs, and follow those label instructions so that you don't overapply. Like overapplying is not better. More is not better when it comes to herbicides. So.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation about like resistance and causing resistance and overapplication by resistance. And
also, it's like,
well, really, more is not better because you can end up killing the leaf but not the plant. Yeah, right. You know, it gives something a whole lot of poison that's supposed to travel through the whole thing, and it's like all of a sudden it just kills part of it, and it's like, well, I guess the rest of the plant's fine.
I think there's a tendency for inexperienced people to be like, well, that's not that effective because it died so slowly, but they don't realize that's what we're trying to do.
Right.
So it actually gets in the roots.
And I think that comes to another great point is that, I have been able to remove, like get above my reluctance of using herbicides, and I bite the bullet and I do it. Right. And the first season I come and I spray and everything dies and it looks great. Well, it doesn't look great. There's a bunch of dead plants there, but it essentially kills what I see in my yard. But then, you know, fall comes around, winter comes around, and then spring comes around. And it's just like, oh man, there is so much more coming up after I just spent all that money and all that time and all that energy to spray. And I think this is kind of what people need to understand about the biology behind a plant is like, they kill what's in front of them, but they still have to do repeated treatments over a temporal period, right? Like it needs to be a temporal thing. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, something would need to be done, and it just all depends on the species and things like that. In some instances, with some types of plants, you could probably spray once, get some grasses going, and keep it out. But other things, yeah, you're going to need to do follow-up treatments. You know, like with hawkweed, I've found that if you spot treat hawkweed in a lawn, it will pop up right next to where you sprayed it. And by spot treating, I mean like if I spray only the plants that I see, that's spot treating. Whereas if you kind of treated the entire lawn, then so you kind of chase it around. And you can choose to do that. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that as long as you're taking the time to do all of those follow-up treatments and chase it around the yard. So the seed bank is still there, and seeds are a real interesting thing. They don't necessarily just sprout up immediately because there's soil and stuff. Sometimes they need another winter cycle, or need some other right condition. So as long as the seeds are still viable in that soil, you're going to end up with with plants coming back up every spring when they resprout. So you will need to treat those as well.
Just out of curiosity, does anyone know what's the
seed bank?
The seed, just how long a hawkweed seed can survive? Like, is it a tree-year seed? Is it a 5-year seed? Is it very?
I thought it was 7 or 8, but
yeah, it's something wicked. It's something,
lot,
yeah, it's something fierce long.
I don't know if that's a hard number.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the stuff I report is like 10, 15 years. Like,
but
they
bull thistle is can be 20 plus years, but I think here maybe less just because it's so wet
it's
here.
So
I'm
wet
guessing
and cool.
Some of them rot.
Yeah.
But yeah, every species.
Every species
different.
Is a little bit different. I do want to hit on something that's. We talked about earlier in the year about biologicals. Biologicals as a form of pest control, very similar to like dealing with hawkweed and stuff like that, but biologicals have a totally different Most people don't, they know about herbicide, they know about pesticide, but they don't really listen or know about like biologicals. And biologicals to me are super important. That's like one of my right-hand arms in terms of growing and being productive. Could you give a very basic understanding of what biologicals are?
Yeah. So biological controls is taking, you know, an animal or insect or, disease, nematodes, and basically trying to control something else with it, whatever that pest happens to be. And so you can control insects with some, and that's probably what you're most used to dealing with. And then you can also control invasive plant species with them. They are typically very heavily regulated too. It takes somebody 10 years and a whole lot of money to get a biological control agent like approved for use in the States. And then they've got to spend a whole bunch of other time and research actually figuring out how to make it work and where it will actually work. So we've dabbled a little bit in both. We've been working with a knotweed biocontrol that would go into we're going to try and catch a can. It might not happen until next year because we've been, after it got approved for use and it's been used a lot, we were still trying to get more species tested for host specificity and things like that. So more on that later. But the thing to remember with biological controls of invasive species, I would never say blythe and Misumi, you should switch to using a biological control on your knotweed right now, because they have so little knotweed that they still have kind of a chance to at least knock it back quite a bit, if not eradicate it. Once you start to use a biological control agent on an invasive plant species or another invasive species, you're just trying to like level that playing field more or less, so that we now have something that will keep this thing in check. Because these things, these plants or insect or whatever it is, when we import them, we don't bring their pests and diseases with them. And so that's often what allows them to do what they do. And so if we, that's the goal then, is to pick something that, these folks have great jobs. They get to go over to like some exotic place where something came from, and then look at all of the cute things or cool things that are eating this plant and figure out which ones aren't eating other things. They take those back and then start doing a bunch of testing on them. But then we also have the stuff that are used in ag settings, and those kind of go through a lot of the same scrutiny and stuff. There's a lot more of them out there. They also, though, have to get permitted through USDA and then approved by the Alaska Division of Agriculture for sale in distribution in the state. And really, that's only happened in, like, I think this year is the first year. So it kind of flew under the radar for a long time. And there wasn't any stuff. And so there wasn't any approval for it to move up here.
Would that include ladybugs?
Yeah. And so the interesting thing about ladybugs is they're really popular to use. But reasons why you shouldn't use them, or a handful of reasons why you shouldn't really use them. One, they're not actually effective. The life stage they get them at and the way they're collected, these things are really hungry. And unless if you're releasing them into a confined space where they simply can't get away, their first instinct is to fly away. And part of that's the way they collect them is off of rocks when they're dormant in California, these wild collections. And so because they're kept then dormant, like their first instinct when they get released and now they're warm enough is to disperse. The other reason is because the species that's often sold that way is not native to the state of Alaska and has been shown to compete pretty well with other species, with other ladybug species in other parts of North America, where they've seen like their native lady beetle populations actually go down with the introductions and establishment of those. So those I don't think are actually, they're not permitted for use in the state or sale or distribution, but there's a lot of other options. And we're working, we have a proposal in with a specialty crop development program to start looking at that big, huge list. It's 50 plus species that you could do and figure out which ones might actually be useful, which ones won't be, and kind of outline ways that people can use them and use them effectively for folks.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to bring this up because earlier you asked me like to write a letter of recommendation for a biological based off of my experience, 10 years of experience using nematodes. A lot of growers use them. There's the research is there. They do work. How well they work is another question, but they do show the highest promise outside of like using other biologicals like BT, which research doesn't really show a huge amount of support for that it's a super effective. And that you were getting ready to, the letter was for support in doing trials. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's a Steinerma species of nematode. And this thing is a generalist predator on fly eggs and maggots. And so that's it can work on the cabbage root maggot and onion root maggot, which are two huge issues we have for the production of those vegetables up here. And so, yeah, we submitted a proposal that did all the other stuff I just talked about, but then we were going to like start some trials on that as kind of like pilot stuff and then see if we can actually get additional funding if we to start doing more with it if it shows promise and we start to get more questions, because there's a lot to wonder about. Like, this nematode isn't really from this place. Nematodes typically, you know, aren't something we usually notice a whole lot of environmental impact to, so we probably won't have anything there, but we don't know how long they actually last in the soil. So from the grower perspective, you know, how often do you need to apply this? You know, what is your exact great timing? Because you need that root maggot to be at the right life stage, because if you applied this stuff too soon and the root maggots weren't there, now all of a sudden you got starving nematodes that are just going to die out.
Spending money on something that's not going to work.
Exactly. And so then, you know, how many times then after that, you know, when does the cold get to them and they start to die out? Or, you know, how often do you really need to apply this in order to keep those things down?
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point, because we've got lots and lots of examples of biologicals going awry, not necessarily in this state, but worldwide. Trying to solve problems, the cane toad comes to mind. And we don't want a cane toad incident for Alaska.
I actually wanted to ask Gino to talk about, like, a lot of people see these historic examples of biologicals that were not tested properly and caused major problems, and what the difference is now versus then. Like, why biologicals are a lot safer now because of the way they're regulated?
Oh, gosh, because, like, I don't remember all the details of the cane toad. We have a VHS tape video about it at my house that my wife took home from her classroom, and it's pretty fascinating. But essentially, because back then when those things happened, somebody looked at it and saw like, oh, wow, this thing eats that pest. Let's take it over, and boom, there it is. And, you know, and they didn't think about it beyond that. So now, though, like, you know, if you're going to do, if you want to introduce something, there's a whole lot of testing that goes on to make sure that it's not going to damage other things of either a cultural or economic importance, or, you know, other importance out there. And so, yeah, there's it's sort of the amount of work that goes into it is a heck of a lot more now, and the amount of caution that goes into it. So there's a lot less to worry about, because somebody else is already worried for you.
Yeah, we've learned some valuable lessons from the past.
Yeah.
I'm sure. And that's how it ought to be, right?
A lot of extensive testing now.
Yeah. Just to wrap this up, how many biologicals are approved for Alaska?
And so I got to back up on the question, right? The way it works is that a company that distributes biological control agents applies for a permit with the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS, to distribute these organisms within a state. And so they make a choice about what organisms they're going to do. I don't know the exact number, but there was around 50 that from two different companies that that applied for those permits, and then we worked with the Division of Ag, and really it was Alex and Joey, who are entomologists, reviewing the list and stuff to see if these anything was jumped out as like alarming and things like that. But there's so the things that have been like rejected or turned back are the lady beetles that we mentioned, ladybugs that people sometimes release, and then mantids. And mantid eggs, because those have proven to be problematic as well as not really all that effective.
Mantid, so, you're talking about praying mantises?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So those things have been kind of rejected by the state and Animal Plant Health Inspection Service for the most part. All the other stuff kind of comes through. A lot of them are things we don't necessarily need. It's just a company covering their bases and having like a list. So maybe if you had a citrus tree in your house that got some sort of issue, you might release, one of these things that we don't really need otherwise. But then there's other stuff, like we mentioned, like this nematode that, hey man, that might be kind of cool. So.
Cool. I think the overall arching story here is that pesticides are a tool in the toolbox to deal with invasive plants, to deal with problematic plants, species. And that they're not always recommended, but when they are recommended, they are a great effective tool. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah. Okay. As long as they're used appropriately.
Yeah. Okay. I thank you so much for your time. We're at the 57-minute mark. Sorry for keeping you longer than we anticipated, but I certainly appreciate it. For the listeners out there, where can they find you?
You can find me at alaskainvasives.org, or if you Google UAF Cooperative Extension Service or the Alaska Forestry Experiment Station, I've got my information should be found there too.
Excellent. I want to thank my co-host Blythe and Musumi, and I want to thank our guest Gino for coming on today and giving us a solid evidence-based assessment of pesticides and pesticides use. Just like a broad fork or a shovel, pesticides are just another tool, if used correctly, are highly efficient and safe, but also contextual and nuanced. This is why Kodiak Soil and Water does so much outreach and education to dispel all the noise attributed to pesticide use. If you have questions about pesticides or pesticide use, we always encourage people to contact us at the district. Listen to all the episodes of Talks Around a Farm Table on KMXT.org and Spotify. This show is in collaboration between Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District and KMXT Radio. You can find me, Ian Zacher, on Facebook at Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District or on the web at www.kodiaksoilandwater.org. Music featured in this episode is Boil the Breakfast by The Chieftains, which is my son's favorite song.